member of WildGamesProductions.com and D20Radio.com.
Hey folks, this is DM Vince. Letting you know, I'm sitting down with Steve Marsh from TSR Alumni Days. He's notable of working on the X and the BX edition, Star Frontiers, and he had his hand in Call of Cthulhu, the first edition. So sit back and relax and enjoy the interview and listen in how he talks about TSR and his work and how he got established. Fun interview. Enjoy, guys. So, Steve, how you doing today?
I'm doing really well. We made contact, and you survived the hurricane.
Yeah, that was pretty bad, that hurricane. So I won't take up too much of your time today. We just wanted to get, touch base and let everybody hear your voice out there and hear your thoughts in actual, sound form instead of just seeing words on a page. So
that
just
sounds good to me.
Yeah. So can you just start off? Can you tell me a little bit about your gaming history and how you got started working at TSR?
Well, back in the 60s, when I was a kid, I was playing a lot of board games.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I'd be able to design a role-playing game. And so I was trying to design one, I'd never actually played miniatures, so I was working from board games and working from the Golden Bough trying to work out a magic system. I wasn't getting very far.
Mm-hmm.
I kept thinking about it. One day, 1974, very beginning of the year, I sat down in a class next to Sandy Peterson.
Oh, okay.
And he had a copy of Dungeons & Dragons, the first printing. And I looked over there and I saw the book, and I didn't even know Sandy, but it looked interesting, so I asked him if I could borrow it. And he said yes. And we started playing together, and I started corresponding with Gary Gygax.
Cool.
And then eventually, Gary wanted me to come out and work for them after I finished law school, doing both game design, maybe a little bit of in-house legal work. And I was interested in that, and I spent a summer out there working for him. And then, not that much longer, he lost complete control of the company, and I got a rather nasty letter from the Blooms telling me that I wasn't needed.
Ooh.
And that I'd never been needed. And, just one of those stupid things someone has written when they've talked to an attorney and are bound determined to irritate someone as badly as possible.
And this was around the time of 85, 86 you got that letter, or?
Oh, I got that letter in right around the turn from 81 to 82.
Oh, so Gary was still with the company, just wasn't in complete control anymore.
Yeah, what happened in that, I don't know if you've ever heard about the Saturday Night Massacre where TSR had its first firing.
I've heard some talk about it, but no one's actually explained it in detail.
What they did is they asked everybody to name two projects they'd worked on in the last year.
Okay.
And if you could not name one project of any type that you'd worked on in the company, you got fired.
Oh, geez.
And they fired 70 people, mostly family and relations and friends of the Blooms, who had been working for a year and never actually worked on anything.
Wow.
I mean, people say, how could they fire all those people? It's like, well, I remember hearing what the test was. It's like, how could you work at a company for a year and never actually touch anything?
Yeah.
Not be able to come up with the name of a single product. You're in the game design department, Well, what did you work on? I hung out for a year. And a number of those people had company cars.
Oh.
And they went back to having a single company car. And they fired all the people that weren't doing any work. And Gary would bounce in and out of kind of control the company. And what would happen is people would get desperate, they'd let him run things. Then when they were looking good again, they would decide to replace him with professional management before he derailed the company. It's like, guys, okay, look, who just saved the company? Who just turned everything around? You know, like the Random House deal where they went from $3 million a year to $9 million a year in business.
Huh.
And solved all sorts of, you know, I mean, Gary never screwed anything up. But then people would go, well, gee, he's not a professional. He'd been an insurance underwriter. He actually had, Gary had some really broad basic training
right.
in a lot of areas. But they're going, oh, no, we can't trust him not to screw this up. And then, you know. Yeah, they go from $9 million to $27 million in revenue, and they're in trouble. How can that happen? You know, because most of what they're doing is just selling to more people.
Huh.
How can you just sell your same product to more people when you're not really changing the amount of product?
True.
Okay. But, you know, you get enough people that are just hanging out, not doing any work. And, you know, they had some other interesting things happen from time to time. And occasionally, you know, originally Gary couldn't imagine how anybody would have any use for scenario packs. Who would buy someone else's scenario work?
Oh,
it's like,
right, okay.
And when Judges Guild won the license, it was like, fine. Except, you know, I remember doing approvals, and it's like, you can't have naked women running around the countryside and making up for their lack of armor by having lots of magic. The whole world will be up there trying to harvest them. And no, you can't have a group that kills every man they meet, including all the male children, and have them be lawful good. Now, I admit the idea of a lawful good society of naked women running around the countryside probably appeals to you, but it's not going to work. We're not going to approve it.
No.
And so Judges Guild started doing unapproved stuff, and people noticed it was selling. And about that time, we had a guy mail in a project from school. He just wanted us to see it, and it was beautiful. And I said, you know, we need to do more of our own stuff. It was kind of Aztec themed, Altars of Tehokan or something. This is working title.
Huh.
It was beautiful. And they, you know, TSR started doing their own supplements as well. And quite frankly, I think a core thing anybody doing a role playing game needs to do is they need to ship it with a core set of encounters in gaming.
Right.
One, so that people get an idea of what gameplay should be like, and two, so that players have a core shared experience. The Against the Giants,
mm-hmm.
Which was a beautiful piece of work, but so many people out there have shared that experience. And so when they're talking about D&D, sure, there's a whole bunch of things they didn't share, talking about a particular age group. But they all have that experience together. What happened when this? And so, you know, my group may be in Alaska, and your group may be in Florida, and somebody else's group may be in Zimbabwe. It's kind of A to Z.
Yeah.
But if we all played through that, then we all had an experience together.
True.
So if we meet up, we all had that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's underappreciated. Oh. It was one of the big strengths of RuneQuest was they had Glorantha as a shared setting.
Right.
And something Glorantha had that Empire of the Petal Throne didn't is you felt you could make it your Glorantha. Whereas Empire of the Petal Throne, a lot of people felt like they couldn't quite get it right.
Yeah, a lot of people think it's a little bit wonky, but I enjoy it.
Well, I enjoyed it, but the question was, could you make it your Petal Throne, or did you have to have Barker's Petal Throne?
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Whereas most people that play RuneQuest have no problem making it their RuneQuest versus, or their Glorantha versus Greg Stafford's. And of course, it helps that Greg keeps changing his mind about what Glorantha really is.
That would help.
And that helps reduce the connection. You know, Gary tried to do the same thing when he started saying dwarvish women have beards. I went, what the heck, Gary? He's going, this will cause everybody to realize that they don't have to listen to every word I say, that they should feel free to ignore me. And I said, okay. And, you know, there are still people out there, oh, yes, Gary Gygax said dwarven women have beards, therefore they all have beards. It's like, they missed the point.
Yeah.
It's like, but I won the argument. I said, see, that won't work. But you'll get, you got, in the early days, you had things. I don't know if you've read any of Stephen Brest's books.
No.
The Vlad Taltov series?
Mm-mm.
They're his D&D campaign.
Oh, really?
That he played in, yeah. Vlad Taltos, you know, is an assassin. And he just happens to be a player character. Now, the rules are kind of different. You know, his elves are actually highly evolved lizards. His dwarves are the natives of the planet. Elves don't use psionics because it never occurred to them. And the real reason elves don't use psionics is I like dwarves and I'm short. If you want to know why, I said why elves don't have. I mean, because it seems elves and psionics. You know, I mean, in most backgrounds, those two kind of go together.
Uh-huh.
It's like, I'm short. Why do tall people get all the good stuff?
Interesting.
You know, I mean, anyway. I think I've probably gone a little bit astray from the question, but
that's okay.
How I ended up working there. And I did a lot of correspondence. And on and off, Gary would hope that I'd be able to come back and work with him.
Mm.
And he kept, you know, the deal was they would use my stuff, and in return, eventually, they would publish the Planes of Reality that I'd worked on. And so, you know, like, Jim Ward was making $20,000, $30,000 a month off one of the products.
Wow.
And the deal was I'd get to do a similar book. And that never happened. And so I never ended up getting paid for things like Sanguine and Ixalchitl. Though, interestingly enough, when they did the Dragon magazine article on Ixalchitl, one of the old guys said, no, it's pronounced Ixalchitl.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than the way it looks. And I go, what? So they wrote that in there. And I asked them, how'd you find that out? And they said, well, you know, so-and-so said, uh-uh, that's how it's pronounced. But,
nice.
You know, it was, and the name actually came from a historian. So did Sanguine. A bunch of citations in the back of a Mormon pamphlet.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I pulled the names off that.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll head on to my next question here.
Okay.
Your first official project with TSR that you got paid for, and did it go as you planned, or was there certain things left out, or how did it work for you?
The first thing I ever got paid for, surprisingly, was Saga, the little minigame. And mm-hmm. The deal was, which seemed kind of strange to me, they were going to pay in-house designers who did games like that royalties, as
right.
if they were working out-house, to kind of encourage them to feel comfortable not leaving the company and doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The stuff I did for Blackmore,
mm-hmm.
I did the underwater encounters and a bunch of stuff. I didn't get paid for that. The stuff of mine ended up in Eldritch Wizardry. I'd done a psionic character class, and they decided just to change that to psionics for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get paid for that.
Oh, wow.
In fact, I didn't get paid for anything they used of mine. And some things, as one guy said, we shouldn't have been paid for that. You know, I added good and evil to the law of chaos. And some other things, the plane's reality, you know. Do they need all those extra alignments? Who knows?
Mm.
I was saying, you know, we ought to just not have law and chaos. Well, chaos is a stand-in for evil, and law is a stand-in for good.
True.
I talked Gary into that. But the only thing I ever got paid for is that I got paid one royalty payment on Saga. Much to my surprise. I said, are they really going to do that? And Gary went back, yes, and here's your check. I thought, okay. But everything else TSR was supposed to pay me for, either in cash or in other things, I never got paid for.
Well, what about the expert book that you had your hand in?
I was working at TSR, so I guess I got salary on that. And
okay.
So I did approvals. I did the experts. I did the expert. And it's funny because I ran into some stuff. TSR often would have stuff around. In fact, talking to Tim Kask, one of the reasons he wasn't sure exactly what I'd done, even though he edited a whole bunch of my work, is it just showed up in the basket of stuff. Gary had a basket of stuff, and he would give it to Tim to work on. And it, and it never, they never quite communicated where it came from. It was obvious in Gary's head, he'd write about it. He'd have these columns saying, so-and-so does this great work, and so-and-so does this. But sit down and have a conversation directly on point. By the way, I got this from here and this from here. Anyway. And so Tim worked on a lot of stuff without knowing where it came from. But we had this pile of stuff, and I remember looking at it going, my gosh, I've got to put this in the expert set. And I remember talking to Tom Moldvay, and he said, no, that was supposed to go in the trash. Which made me feel much better. I remember just looking at it going, how am I going to do this? But no, I mean, it was basically, watches regularize this. The original rules, I don't know if you know the story behind that, but Dave Arneson basically had the Castle and Crusade Society.
Right.
And Dave said, let's play individual characters at one castle. It's like, okay, and they really enjoyed it, but he never actually explained the rules that well to them. And Gary said, we got to do this as a game. Well, like the combat system. Okay. You had two different ways to do it. One, you could run them like miniature characters. So this guy was equivalent of one man. This guy was equivalent of a five-man unit. This guy was equivalent of a hero. Because Chainmail had some fantasy overlays.
Right.
And then Gary made up an alternative combat system. And then if you've seen Dave Arneson stuff, the hit location tables and his own game with fixed hit points, that was Greg's actual system. But of course, he's rolling the dice behind a screen just telling people results, and they don't know what they're doing. It's just like Arneson, the way a magic user went up is he learned all the spells at one level, then he moved up to the next circle. And since you're not increasing in hit points with level,
mm-hmm.
a whole bunch of things about leveling didn't really matter. You're just moving up circles. But so Gary basically is making up D&D from whole cloth, just with the idea that you can do role-playing. And he has the chainmail rules, and so it's an amazing thing, and that's why artists will go, well, that's not what I was thinking. They sure got that wrong. I had nothing to do with that. If you read like his early bio in TSR's magazine,
right.
that he did, and some of his other early writing, and you see his rules, and you go, okay, I understand why Dave says that's not what I was thinking, because he was thinking fixed hit points and a muchly different approach to gaming.
He was thinking more of a war gaming standpoint. Sounds like more war gaming than anything else.
Well, and of course, the original rules, Gary just thought everybody would customize them to their own game. And so when you think, you think Steve and Brush, you think, well, that's an alternative, whereas Gary would have said, that's perfect. And you go, okay, that doesn't look anything like, the Greyhawk setting. And Gary would go, well, of course not. That's what I intend. People would just take these and make them. And they discovered that, one, they couldn't have tournaments. And two, most gamers were not comfortable remaking the rules.
Right.
Now, I played with Sandy Peterson. Gee, Sandy was completely comfortable remaking the rules from scratch. In fact, for a while, I thought, if we worked at it, we could probably do a new game every 2 weeks. maybe once a month with polish. You know, I was doing some stuff with Sandy. I said, we could just do a new role-playing game once a month. And it didn't seem that hard. And we could probably have vastly different mechanics. And I remember doing one on quantum states. You know, every time you went up a level, basically, you went up a quantum state. In combat, you compared quantum state levels, and you took real wounds, but they were, you know, like your cat. If your cat attacks you, he's several quantum states below you, all he can do is scratch you. it's a hit pointless combat system, but at certain levels, the things become meaningless.
Right.
Your cat is never going to, no matter how much he attacks you, he's not going to win.
Well, we never know.
You know, especially if he's been declawed.
Yeah.
I don't see a real market for a new role-playing game once a month. It's
no.
Radically different. Whereas what Chaosium did, where they had similar mechanics in different games, that, you know, the fact that you can move from Call of Cthulhu to related games fairly easily actually makes them more attractive. Because you don't have to relearn the systems. You can go from Stormbringer to Call of Cthulhu to Glorantha.
Yeah, true.
TSR, originally they had a Barsoom game. You could play John Carter of Mars.
Mm.
And they had Boot Hill. They had their top secret spy game, which actually got them investigated by the CIA once.
Yes, I remember. Someone told me this story about how he was in a casino, and they thought that he was actually doing something to rob the casino.
But the best one is when they got investigated in Lake Geneva.
Yeah,
they were doing some moves by card, sending postcards.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody had something about killing this guy in the Middle East. Well, it happened to be that the names and the identities and the roles and the jobs matched up. One of those accidents.
Oh, no.
And somebody who knew what they were doing actually saw the card.
Oh.
Which is a huge coincidence. And the first thought they wanted to know was, why would anybody want to kill him? It's an innocuous guy who's out in the open, okay? It's like, somebody's going to kill him? And they trace it back to Lake Geneva, and they show up at the game company headquarters, and they walk in, and they realize, as they're starting to talk with the designer, one of the designers who had sent this card, because they asked, can I talk to so-and-so? It's like, do you know? And the guy realizes, he's in a game company. And then the interview falls apart, and he just wants to get out of there, where they've got lots of questions for him. And so it was much less a disaster when poor Steve Jackson got raided by the Secret Service.
Oh, boy.
I don't know if you've heard about it. He was doing a cyberpunk game, and some idiot thought it was real.
Yeah, I did hear about that.
And they seized all of his stuff. And he won the lawsuit that came afterwards, but it was like, guys, cyberpunk is not real. Especially with the kind of technology they had then. It's like, it's not even close to becoming real.
No, not even.
He's now running a huge terrorist network out of Austin, Texas.
Impossible.
Now maybe, if they thought he was going to try and create a pothole sealing network or something, I can see that coming out of Austin, Texas.
Yes.
Back then, not now, it's like a homegrown beer. And microbrew distilleries aren't illegal. But anyway, I always felt sorry for Steve Jackson. It's like, surely, if they should have shown up, realized it was a game company and been embarrassed.
Yeah, really.
And TSR, by the way, was a much calmer place than some other game companies.
I heard from various other designers and authors that they used to have a lot of fun, and it was a good place to work.
It was very pleasant. Now, game testing was done in the evenings.
Right.
You wanted to game test like a scenario or something. And whoever was running it provided chips and soda. So if you wanted to play test something, you had to do it on your own time, but they'd pay you in chips and soda. But, and Lawrence Schick would do his chunk rock. which is music sped up so it sounds like chipmunks singing punk. And some pieces of music do that. They sound like punk rock sung by chipmunks. And Lawrence, who had a vast classical music library, also liked to do, liked the punk, because he said it felt alive. And the chunk rock was just like, yes. You had to just find just the perfect piece, and he would speed it up, and then he would produce these chunk rock albums. But, you know, I mean, compare that, there were some places where the marijuana was real heavy. And another one, they were talking about the amount of sex and drugs they were doing. And, you just look at that and you think, my gosh, their HR, if they'd had an HR department, they would have, you know, had a heart attack. Whereas TSR, you know, it's sit around, BS, eat chips, and drink soda. And play some chunk rock, maybe, if you're lucky. You know?
Water gun fights.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was... And, you know, I mean, they had one person who for a while was dressing inappropriately. Bless her heart, she was reading New York fashion magazines. And sheer blouses and the braless look were in.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And, you know, I mean, everybody just kind of looked the other way. You know, just, you know, nobody stared. Nobody took his invitation to do anything. Everybody just kind of, you know, you just can't, you know, stare at someone that's half naked. And they were dressing out of fashion magazines. They thought they were, you know, they thought it was completely appropriate.
One of those, I can't believe she wore that. Well, I better not get caught staring.
Yeah, so, I mean, so there's a whole bunch about it I can't tell you because I always look the other way. And you look back now, well, gee, you know, but it was, oh. I mean, and that was TSR, where, you know, you wouldn't say anything because, you know, you don't want to hurt someone's feelings.
Yes.
And everybody's polite enough that nobody's taking advantage of the situation. And, you know, it was a good group, you know. They used to talk about Tom Wham, even the janitor's a game designer. Because that was Tom's official job. He was a janitor. He was, and he had a closet where he kept huge stereo equipment, and he did his game designing. And you can think of some of Tom's designs in the context of a real limited space to work with.
Yeah, literally.
And it's just great. I mean, how many people have a janitor who's a world-class game designer?
Nobody.
But, you know, I mean, Tom enjoyed being the janitor. They needed one, and, you know, so he volunteered, and he actually did the work.
Yeah.
And that way he said he could design games in his own time without having to, you know, deal with people.
True.
And only show them when they were ready. I can't speak for him now, but at the time, he was just a wonderful guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Oh, it makes sense, totally. You actually answered a couple other questions when you were answering other questions, so I'll just skip over to the next one. You were credited in Star Frontiers. How much work did you actually put into that, and did you wish you'd do more for that?
I got to work on some of the playtesting, and I came up with a couple of small ideas. You know, things like if you run stuff in sync with someone's brainwaves only a little bit slower, people who aren't really paying attention will fall asleep. Well, actually, they'll just kind of fade off into a state that's very similar to being asleep.
Hypnotic state, maybe?
Yeah, it's kind of like a hypnotic state. It's a meditative state.
Right.
So you can just kind of slow people's brainwaves down by pulsing low-level sound, flashing light at the very edge of visible, in a very slow, you know, pulse. And it's great because if you actually hit them, they wake back up. You know, it's kind of like the lightest version of the sleep spell. I mean, anybody who's really alert and doing something doesn't fade off. Anybody who's threatened doesn't fade off. A loud noise wakes them back up. It's like a technological sleep spell.
Yeah.
With all the limits it should have had. But Star Frontiers is actually a rather good game.
Yes, I loved it.
It's really too bad the Buck Rogers thing happened, because it kind of resulted in the end of Star Frontiers. And, you know, no offense to Buck Rogers, but, you know, a hideous television property. It's not a good substitute for an excellent game.
No, we all know why that game was brought in, and we don't need to go there. But that's interesting. But I also saw you were credited on working of Call of Cthulhu, the first edition book, but I understand now, because you were friends with Sandy, so.
Well, yeah, there's a whole backstory to that.
Oh, good.
Now, this was back when we were doing new game systems a lot. And I thought, you know, we had this thing called American Gothic. Okay?
Right.
And Sandy said, that's a great idea. And so he did one based on Steve Jackson's The Fantasy Trip. And you had Cthulhu as one of the elements. And when I sold a bunch of old stuff I had, Sandy credited American Gothic as the starting point for Call of Cthulhu. And what's funny is the guy at the auction got it at a real good price, and then some other people realized what Sandy had said, and then they tried to get it after the auction was over. And the last time someone contacted me, they offered him like $5,000-$6,000 for it, until they discovered the guy collects Ferraris.
Jeez.
And he had framed it and put it in his entranceway. He's going, $5,000-$6,000, what's that? That's nothing.
Yeah.
And so they gave up on it. But it did not have that much in common. And then Chaosium was looking to do a Call of Cthulhu game. All they had was stuff that was terrible. And so Sandy said, you know, I can do that. And Sandy did a beautiful job. And I got to play test it. And a long time ago, when I play tested stuff, I, without meaning to, would always end up mini-maxing things.
Right.
If there was a seam or a weakness in a system or a rule, you would find my character sitting in it. Without spending a lot of time on it.
Right.
You know, the first time I played the Russo-Finnish War game, the SPI did. You know, the Finns took the northernmost Russian city and put the entire Russian army out of supply. And it all went away within three turns, you know.
Wow.
And it's a possible exploit in the game if the Russian player is playing it normally. And the Finnish player is willing to actually just commit that way. And the first time I played it, I just thought, well, I'll try this. The Stormbringer rules had to be changed. Because, you know, I didn't think about it, I just did this. You know, it's like, well, gee, we can't have that in the game. At least not that way. And so Sandy would haul me in for playtesting stuff. Because I would just do things without even thinking about it. You know, you'd watch how I played, and you go, huh, that's not what that rule's meant to do. It's not meant to give that person infinite mythos knowledge without any sanity loss, or it's not, you know what I mean? And, you know, I wasn't trying to do anything wrong. It wasn't wrong, it was just available.
Right.
But so I got to play test Call of Cthulhu, and it was just a beautiful initial work. Sandy took what they had and just did a beautiful job with it.
Yeah, I have the fourth edition of the book, and it's a very good game, very smooth at that point.
Yeah, and all I did was find some exploits and get him started thinking about adding Cthulhu to, you know, modern American fantasy. I was actually thinking Manly Wade Wellman.
If I ever write something, I'm going to give it to you to find the exploits in it.
At least, you know, I mean, I used to. I haven't done that in a while. At least not in a year. You know, it's embarrassing because it's like, well, gee. And I'm not intending to create exploits, or I just happen to find them. If that makes any sense.
No, yeah, I understand. Well, that's interesting.
And I'm not spending a lot of time on it. I'm just playing.
Yeah.
it's just happening. It's like, and I, a lot of times I don't even realize it's an exploit. Most of the time I don't. It's just, you know, well, gee, how come your character's not doing that? you know, Call of Cthulhu is not a game that you're supposed to win.
No, not at all.
Whereas, of course, I thought you were supposed to win it. but, you know, and I did some stuff with, I don't know if you've ever seen the Hero Game stuff. I'm in some of the early, some of the credits on their Fantasy Hero sequence.
For?
The miscellaneous stuff I did. Because Champions as a game is not a bad game. It's an excellent game for what it captures. Especially with its biting up stun and
oh, I see. Okay.
And killing power. I don't know if you ever played Champions.
No, I was actually playing Marvel Super Heroes or V&V at the time.
Yeah, I mean, V&V is kind of a D&D approach.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed playing it. And the author's an excellent person.
Mm-hmm.
Just delightful. And Marvel is fun to do a little bit of design work with. I did some scenario design just for the heck of it. I like to play games to play them as a game designer rather than as a player, if that makes any sense. So a lot of times I'll play a game in order to create scenarios.
Right.
Not necessarily to play them out either, just to work through what should you do to do that and how to make it work. But Champions captures superheroes very well. The stun... And interestingly enough, if I were going to do Black Company, Glenn Cook series,
right,
the Taken are all superheroes.
Interesting.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you've got normal people, right?
Yeah.
Think a bunch of, and maybe up to, you know, fourth or fifth level, and then you've got superheroes. You know, and they have things like regeneration, and, you know.
Cool. Anyway, I never got into Champions. The most I strayed away from the two games was I played DC Heroes. That was probably the furthest I went into superhero stuff.
And DC Heroes had some really interesting stuff in terms of being able to design things.
Oh, yeah. Mayfair did a good job on that system. Was it Mayfield?
Yeah, at least from a designer's viewpoint.
Yeah.
If you want to do scenario design.
True.
I can't vouch for it from a player, but I really enjoyed playing around with it. But, you know, for the longest time, I would just, you know, grab things and play with them.
Right.
To see what you could design with them. And so I would end up with credits here and there, because I would write people, make suggestions, send them, you know, things. They go, huh, that's neat. Hmm. You know, and I'd end up with a credit here, a credit there. It's like John Sapienza would say, this is how you regulate this, or this is how you make it more regular, more structured, more sensible. And he's responsible for a whole bunch of stuff. You know, now he's just responsible for stuff at Worldcons and science fiction, but... John Sapienza did an incredible amount of nice precision organizing work that shows up in RuneQuest, that shows up in D&D.
Right.
You know, he just... a lot of stuff, he got credits for, but nobody understood what the credits were for. But that's what they were for. Anyway, next question.
Okay, so let's fast forward. Let's fast forward a little bit in time and go to when third edition came out for Dungeons and Dragons. Monty Cook's third edition, and the D20 system that a lot of people said changed the face of D&D as we know it, and a lot of people refer to it as the edition that shall not be named as a little side joke. What are your thoughts on Monty Cook's 3E?
Well, I like the D20 concept, but then of course. Someone said, gee, you came up with that 6 years before or 10 years before. So I had published some stuff, you know, as an alternative.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a great alternative. You know, second edition was an overlay, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And it has many of the issues an overlay creates.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not, you know, many good things, but a lot of it is just technical or very bland. You know, they decided, by golly, they were going to produce Planes Reality, and they weren't going to use anything, you know, they were going to try and preempt it, so I wouldn't. It's like, okay, you know, wish you guys well, but and it comes off very bland. And the third edition, I really didn't have anything to do with, other than the idea they were going to basically wipe all the credits clean and start over.
Yeah.
Oh. And that's fine, except, of course, they used my Sanguine and some of my other critters. But, you know, I think they need to do something with the game. And the structure of the license allowed people to, you know, Osric and all the other projects.
Right.
Allowed them basically to bring back first edition. And depending how you interpret the first edition.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, what you thought about the whole OSR movement.
I think it's kind of fun. You know, it leads you to customization.
You don't think it's a bunch of old grognards just saying, ha, we don't like that stuff that's out, so we're going to do our own stuff?
Well, that's what all gaming is.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, it's got a niche, and I think it's fun. You know, one of the funny things is the whole AD&D versus, you know, regular D&D.
Okay.
Because AD&D, the concept was what you would do is you would have a full-fledged system that people could play in tournaments would be the same everywhere.
Right. That was the purpose of first, yeah. Or advanced.
And it kind of sprang because we had a medical doctor said, I can write a textbook. Well, yeah, you can write a textbook, and you could write a game system if you had a complete support crew doing it for you. But, you know, that didn't work out too well. But you had basic and you had advanced, and they go, wait a moment, that's actually a complete system. And then they came up with the what I'll call D&D versus AD&D, and that was simplified base rules that you could play with and build off of. So the AD&D would be the complex, complete system for tournament use.
Right.
So everybody would have be on the same page. And then you had the expert set and the rest, which was, this is a simplified, coherent system that you can play with, suitable for modification and expansion. And they actually intended to have two different products out there, one to encourage people to do whatever they wanted with and have a simplified base to work from. So you wouldn't have to, for example, keep track of regions for spells and, you know, all the miscellaneous complex stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Osric-type movement, and I don't mean to, you know, put one group ahead of the other, but it's nice because it says, hey, you know, you are free to do with this game what you want. Do you want the new 4th edition that plays kind of like World of Warcraft? You know, in person rather than online? Okay, you can play that. You want to do something else? You can do that. You know, the one thing I do miss is you don't have chainmail type combat anything.
No.
So that, you know, you go up a couple levels, now you're fighting like two men, which means you attack twice a round. You know, a Balrog with 10 hit dice, which was a huge monster back in the day.
Yep.
If he's got 10 hit dice, he attacks 10 times. Plus his area of effect attack and special attacks.
Oh, yeah.
And that's suddenly a really fearsome character. Instead of basically being able to kill one of a mob every other round, he can destroy an entire mob every round.
Yeah.
And that's a different level.
Mm-hmm.
But that sort of thing, Yeah, and there are alternative things you can do with magic users, you know.
Right.
You know, fighters are basically getting, let's say an 8th level fighter has 8 hit dice, so he gets 8 attacks, 8 individual attacks, whereas a magic user gets one at level 8, gets one 8 hit die attack.
Right. You do that.
So, and, you know, there are a lot of things you can do. And one of the neat things about D&D is it gave people more hit points.
Yes.
With levels. And I always liked, of course, this name has been, term has been ruined by alternative medicine, but the homeopathic system, which comes from homeopathic magic, which means when you're up a level, you're actually more resilient against death. And because you're somewhat magical, all of your resistance to death is tied into your body. So eventually, I guess you can kill someone by hacking at their foot. But that's why when you hack at their foot, it doesn't come off. Because they are a coherent, consistent, magical creature.
Right.
And a number of groups ended up doing that in RuneQuest when they started doing hero questing.
Huh.
You know, you had a body of hit points. They combined a number of factors to make the game a little bit less brittle and a little bit more granular. You know, do you have fights that are brittle, meaning eventually somebody gets lucky, or do you have fights that are abrasive, meaning people get ground down? And D&D made for much more grinding, which meant that you had much less random character death. And that's the problem with some critical hit systems, is that basically what happens is randomly, eventually something's going to get you. Someone said, if you've got a superhero and he's facing 20 kobolds and they're only 2 hit points each, of course they all fire missile weapons, because they'll get a critical hit. You know, so nobody fears a superhero. You just need a bunch of, you know. On the other hand, you know, that made me think of masses of elves. The price for elven mercenaries is way too low, because they can all cast sleep spells. And so each elven mercenary can take out a dozen or so of the enemy in the first round, at range. Obviously, you know, magical miniatures battles were a lot of fun when I was doing them. Especially the elven mercenaries, who turned out to be a really great, great hire.
Okay, so I was going to ask you your thoughts on 4th edition and the way Wizards of the Coast is taking D&D right now.
Well, it's a nice crossover with World of Warcraft type play.
Didn't White Wolf try that, though, making a World of Warcraft game that bombed?
Well, World of Warcraft is a game, sure, because
there already was one.
Yeah, there already is one. But to take D&D that way, it's an interesting idea. You know, and I think we'll have a lot better idea of how successful it was 10 years from now.
What we're looking at, 6th edition?
One tank, one healer, 3 DPS. Party rules. It makes certain types of scenario design much easier. Almost mechanically, in the ease of design. It's a play style that... Okay, I'm going to go back to what happened down in Chicago in the 70s.
Okay.
Led to Greyhawk. Gary Gygax, when he was doing D&D, he anticipated characters getting to 10th, maybe 11th level after years of play, and obviously being ready for retirement about the time they're ready to build a keep. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But he was working on a model where you and your buds got together and played every other weekend or maybe once a month. All right?
Okay.
And that was part of why the idea, why would anybody want to buy pre-made scenarios? That and the way Blackmore did not sell. At least people were not very receptive to the Blackmore pre-made scenario.
Really?
That has, well, it was a very kind of, have you seen the supplement?
Yes.
In Temple of the Frog, I mean, the problem is it's a very narrow niche. A lot of positive stuff about it, mind you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, how many times are you going to play through it?
True.
At what level? You know what I mean? Now, what happened in Chicago is you had some kids playing. And I actually roomed with one of them for a while when I was in law school as an engineering major. But they were playing 7 nights a week, 5 hours a night or more.
Hardcore.
And they're about to become the first 24/7 gamers. Now, the first thing that happens is you just consume content at an inhuman rate. Second thing that happens is you get through a year's worth of play in the old style in a week or two. So you have done 2 years a month, 3 years a month, which leads you to much higher levels. And they invented, for example, cursed armor and cursed weapons that could kill player characters.
Yes.
That was the whole, I mean, you know, seriously cursed stuff versus, you know, the occasional minus one sword that someone accidentally grabs onto and has to have a cleric, you know, cut him loose of.
Yes.
Oh, and you should have had the magic user analyze magic first.
Oops.
Before he grabbed onto the loot, you know. Like, you know, come on, guys, wait your turn. Don't steal loot. Bad things might happen to you. The cleric may wait a while. Or you can always grab a cursed sword that you have to hit something that needs magic to hit. People keep them for that purpose.
Is this where...
But they had this, you know,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
They had this serious minus 6, you know, minus 12. So suddenly your armor is 12 classes the worst, and you're hitting 12 classes the worst. Like, whoa, you know, that's a huge swing. But they did that because they had so much content going on.
Mm-hmm.
And they were playing so often. And if you've got people playing a lot, I think your play style's different. And that goes to, for example, magic users. Should a magic user have a Vancian handful of spells in his head? Well, if you're going to play through 2-3 encounters, you know, a magic user is only going to cast 5-6 spells in a night, sure. Maybe you're going to do that, recharge, and, you know, do the next day of play in a play session. Because you don't have that much going on. You know, how much healing does a priest need to do? How banged up are your melee guys going to get?
Right.
Okay, that's a play style. But if I'm going to play intensely, and we're going to have 50 encounters in a night, I think perhaps magic users need to regenerate their spells faster, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does.
And healers need, you know, I mean, you get to a World of Warcraft kind of, I don't know if you ever played the game.
Yeah, I have.
Okay, so, you know, you get to where you need to have recharge in terms of, you know, minutes or seconds rather than hours
right.
or days. And so I can see what they're doing with the game, and it may very well play better for, especially as your age groups get younger. You know, that said, my 11-year-old, she's gone to North Texas RPG Con the last 2 years in a row.
Right.
And she's really enjoyed playing Osric style. You know, the various variations of old style. And, you know, she's just had a delightful time with it.
Oh, good.
But, you know, we're talking episodic play. And she's just, I mean, she plans to go next year. She plans to take Kim Kask more donuts. He's got a particular brand of donut he likes. And we were lost for 45 minutes trying to get them last time. This time we're going to get faster, but she's like, yes, I will bring 3 dozen donuts for Tim Kask again. We'll go next year, right, Dad? Yes, we'll go to NTR.
What type of donut does Tim Kask love?
What's that?
What type of donut does Tim Cass love?
Oh, it's a, that chain.
Oh, is
my
it?
Mine's gone blank.
Krispy Kreme or?
Yeah, Krispy Kremes.
Oh, okay.
You know, and she's all for getting him 3 dozen. Just so, you know, he has enough for himself after the fans get after them.
Yeah.
Which I thought, that's a, you know, I mean, especially since I'm paying for it, she's all more than excited to get at least 3 dozen.
True.
You know,
that's interesting to know.
So, you know, younger kids can play the other kind. It's just a different kind of how long are you going to play the game? How immersed are you going to get? You know, are you going to be OCD compulsive about playing it, or are you going to be relaxed and social?
Yeah,
what's one way to look at it? Obviously not necessarily the best. But, and so, you know, I'm not totally negative on it. I mean, I think when you look at superhero games and the way they recharge power, in many ways what you've done is you've switched from an old-fashioned miniatures-based role-playing game where the characters are very Tolkien-esque mm-hmm. in terms of the amount of magic they have, how well they heal, the amount of healing and other stuff available to them, to something that's more like a superhero game where the characters are up and at it, slugging their way across the city, multiple encounters, lots of recovery, bing, bing, bing. And I think there's room for both kinds of games. You know, I've been pleased to see Steve Jackson games, both Munchkin, which is just really a hoot, and, you know, his core game, which he does the expansions for. And I loved an interview. I've been listening to the Writing Excuses podcast. Like, I've given 3 years of them, and, they're weekly, it's like 30, 40 episodes a year on CD. And Steve Jackson, when they were talking, what do I have to do to write, you know, one of your scenarios? It's like, well, convince me this one will be worth it. When he does the licensed adaptations, you know, they're basically a lot of work. I mean, they do a little bit better than break even, but, you know, from a commercial viewpoint versus someone really loved it, they're probably not worth the effort. But, you know, I mean, Jim Butcher's role-playing game apparently selling well enough, and people are enjoying it. I don't know if you've played Dogs in the Vineyard.
Yes.
And someone did a Serenity adaptation, so you could play Firefly with Dogs in the Vineyard.
I've seen that, yeah.
Which I was actually pretty impressed, because it caught what happens in Firefly. You know, they're not Mormon missionaries with six-shooters there, which I thought was a great idea. Instead, they're, you know, mercenaries with hearts of gold who stumble into things and basically do the same sort of solutions. But so, you know, it appears that there's a lot of room for things, and especially since, you know, they create a license that allows older-style play to still exist, I think 4th edition of D&D doesn't hurt anything, if that makes any sense.
No.
Now, if they had occupied the field and completely destroyed and blocked episodic gaming, that'd be one thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But there's just, you know, there's a lot of flexibility out there, and some groups are more loyal than others. At one time, for every copy of Call of Cthulhu, Chaosium had, in the current print run, they could expect to sell 0.9. So for every 10, they'd sell 9 copies of whatever supplements they were producing.
Huh.
But they had extremely high-quality supplements.
Yeah.
You know, Shadows of Yogg-Sothoth and the rest. I mean, just some Dreamlands, which is very, very... I mean, just a bunch of it. And, you know, that's a loyal core group. It kept Chaosium as a company solvent, kept them around in spite of all the other problems they had. You know, Stormbringer, it's too bad they did not do more scenarios for that and more product. But, you know, that was one that had a fan base that very much enjoyed it. It was what they considered their, you know, their game for munchkins. You two can have a bunch of enslaved demons and go around and, you know, thrash the world. But, you know, I think there's a lot of niches, and I think the more kinds of rules and the more approaches you have, the better.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wish Wizards of the Coast the best with, you know, 4th edition. I don't plan to play it. I can play World of Warcraft. You know?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. So my last question for you is kind of a on-the-spot goofy question for you, but
okay.
Let's see if you can go for it. If you could be a household appliance, which household appliance would you be and why?
I was about to say the air conditioning unit because summer's been the hottest one ever, but I'm not sure that's an appliance.
It could be.
Or the microwave because it's useful.
The microwave because, yeah.
Because it's useful.
Yeah.
If I was going to be a household appliance, I'd want to be useful.
Yeah.
I guess I should have more imagination.
Oh, I had one of the designers from White Wolf when I asked him that question. I don't know. Do you know Eddie Webb?
No.
He's one of the designers from White Wolf. He said he wanted to be an iPhone. I'm like, that's not a household appliance. He's like, if you think about it, it really is. I'm like, oh, okay.
Or an iTouch, you know, that one, you know.
Yeah.
I got somebody trying to get me interested in buying a Kindle. It's like, well, I've got the app. Why do I need the device?
Very true, yeah. No point in having a device.
You know, the app is free. The device costs money. Okay. And the app is much smaller.
Yeah.
You know, but White Wolf's another great example of a niche.
Yes.
And the whole reboot they did of the whole universe, that was an interesting thing.
I know it was a very mixed review with fans, but it was needed in the overall long run, so.
Well, I mean, the problem is, most of the time when you're developing a game, you do not have a coherent worldview, or coherent enough. And you get accretions. And then you get occurrences, and at some point you get so much mass of it that perhaps rather than updating your COBOL database, you should switch to Pascal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Back in the day, computers were much smaller, they used to talk about toxic side effects from databases. Because generally, large programs would generate crap. It would just kind of end up sitting around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd have, for example, a data stream that was supposed to be 20 bits long. So, and someone would stick 24 bits of data instead of properly adjusting for it. It would just cut 4 bits of data off and stick it someplace. And after a while, you'd have a whole bunch of this stuff just sitting there. And you know, like, where did it come from? What's it used for? Then you would have, you know, as you would upgrade your software, you would eventually clean it all out, or try to. But you get toxic side effects, and games can get that way. And I think, you know, by rebooting it, they work their way through, and perhaps they have, you know, I'm hoping they have a cleaner product.
Mm-hmm.
And one that's better balanced across their play lines.
True.
You know, would I have made all the choices they made? No, but I mean, they made a lot of choices. Gee, and the way they wrapped it up.
Well, there's only so long you can postpone the whole Kane's coming to end the world thing, so.
Yeah, so, you know, I picked up a whole bunch of books and materials, all the various end of the world things, and I read through them all.
The Time of Judgment, yeah.
Yeah, so that'd be interesting. Maybe I'd done this differently here. I would have preferred to see a better fight there, you know. But it was nicely done. I mean, you know, everybody's a critic.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, now they've got that out of the way. Versus, you know, Shadowrun, which is the apocalypse is going to start in 2030 or thereabouts. Okay, when you get closer to 2030, and somebody else had, I think it was 2011. Ah, my mind's gone blank. I got the wrong date. It is 2011. Anyway, you know, you get close enough to when it's supposed to start. You know, you can keep it or you can change your start date. I don't know if you ever read Ariel by Stephen Boyette.
Yeah.
And then he did his follow-up, LG Beach, just recently.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yes, and what he did is he just rewrote Ariel to make it more current. Now, LG Beach is a completely different story, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But the date of the apocalypse and everything going forward has been moved up, so that when you talk about things, they're current things. So instead of lots and lots of anachronisms left over from, because you know Ariel happened years ago, and so having an apocalypse then makes the date of it and all the stuff forwards a great deal out of touch from your modern reader. And so instead of, he just moved it all. And it works really well. Now, at the end of LG Beach, you realize two things. One is that unicorns are eventually doomed. And two, they deserve it.
Oh, jeez.
They're a source of magical power. And people are going to hunt them for their horns. And you realize they're going to succeed, but they deserve it. That's not the story. That's just an observation.
Huh.
The story is a completely different story. But Ariel comes back and needs help from his old familiar. And it's actually the story of his old familiar's son. It's just very nicely done.
Okay. Cool.
Oh.
Well,
and if you were in town, I'd give you a copy.
I don't know where you're exactly at, but...
Well, I'm in Dallas, and I think you're somewhere on the East Coast.
I'm in Pennsylvania.
Oh. But I was going through books to decide I was going to clear out, and that was one of them. So.
Huh.
But, you know, it's not a bad book.
You're just done with it.
Yeah, and, you know, it doesn't have a lot of value for rereading, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I've read books like that, yeah.
Some stories, there's a lot to reread in them. Some, once you've gone through the entire permutation of the plot and what happens, there's not that much left. But there's going to be probably at least one more story in that setting, using one of the characters, which ought to be very interesting.
Okay.
But he got sidetracked, of all things, doing music.
Cool.
DJing. And that's why there's been so little written output from him.
Okay.
Sandy Peterson, you know, got hired by computer game companies.
Oh, is that where? Oh, okay.
Yeah, what happened was he went out to a convention and they started. These computer companies were trolling the role playing game guys looking for designers. If you can surely have somebody here. And then Sandy went out and interviewed, got a job, and then from there he eventually ended up working for id, and then he worked for the guys at Age Empires Ensemble. And then when Microsoft decided to close Ensemble out to maximize short-term revenue, Sandy started teaching at SMU, and now he's running with, I think, Barking Wizards to double-check. They just switched, you know, just gone. They're using an existing game company to do some startup stuff for some games.
All right, well, I think that's all the questions I have for you today.
Okay. Did anything else come to mind? Is there any other long... it's too bad there's not a lot of gossip.
No, not right now.
Frank Netzer's a nice guy. Tim Kask, you know, is great to deal with. You know, most... Jeff D. is just a gentleman and a scholar.
Did you work with Gene Wells at all, or...?
Somewhat. Gene Wells was the only person who liked the Gore books.
Yeah.
With the TSR.
Yeah.
Which I found okay. And she just liked them. She liked them in Rule Reversal.
Right.
It's like, okay, but you know, it was like, and the worst thing about the Gore books was to discover that all the things that were bad about them were what the author liked.
Hmm.
It was like, and you know, the guy's still out there, still trying to write more of them. It's like, oh no. But no, Jean Wells stuck in my mind because she liked the Gore books. Okay. Thank you very much. It was interesting to know. And she was dating Skip Williams for a while. Skip was a really nice guy.
Yeah.
You know, Errol Otis, I should have stolen his, he did a, we were doing hairy rhinoceroses. I wanted to do them as intelligent so that you could have a herd of them and they would act as, you know, you get tactics out of them. And he thought, that's silly. So the next thing you know, there's a beautiful sketch of a hairy rhinoceros smoking a pipe and sitting in a lounge chair. Well, sitting in, you know, an overstuffed chair by a fireplace. So that's what people are going to think when they think intelligent hairy rhinos. They're not going to think some primitive tribe without tools or clothes, you know, but capable of intelligent tactics. Well, you know, you're probably right. But, you know, he's around still doing artwork. You know, I wish I had some gossip, but there's no, you know, it's hard to think of anything negative to say about anybody except for the Blooms, and that's all been said.
Yeah, it really has. Well, you could talk about Lorraine. Oh, you really didn't know her well, did you?
Lorraine Gygax?
No, the one that took over for TSR when Gary was pushed out.
Oh, Lorraine. Yeah. Lorraine Williams.
Yeah, Williams.
Yeah, she's referred to as the Pog, and people used to think that, I mean, some sort of reference to pig, and it just meant person who ousted Gygax. It's not like it has any, all the nasty, or like she's Pog-shaped, you know, like, what's a Pog-shape? You know, no, she's fat. That has nothing to do with the term. You know, all the things people try to add to the term to give it meaning, you know, give it some sort of nasty, weird meaning. No, none of those. Were just person who ousted Gygax. I remember Gary used to say she locked his office and she burned everything in it. And I thought that was, he was being, that was a metaphor. It turned out actually she got rid of everything in his office.
It's like, yeah.
Okay. It includes some stuff that was mine. The original Star Strands manuscripts and some other stuff. It's like, well, gee. And she's the one that ordered all the interior artwork thrown out. I'm going to, you know, toss that on the trash heap and burn it as well. And somebody once saved a bunch of it and it's shown up at auction since. Like, it was being thrown out. Yeah, but she just thought it was, she didn't like the quality or the style. But, you know, I mean, that was her decision for most of that stuff, except, of course, third-party manuscripts that TSR had not yet paid for. I didn't realize that she'd actually thrown them out. I thought they were just lost somewhere in TSR, and eventually I'd get them back.
And she's a person I'd like to get on the phone and talk to about, but I doubt I'll be able to do that ever. But,
well, she kind of disappeared. She sold a bunch of memorabilia, and that she, you know, made some more money. You know, and she did some nice things as well as some bad things. She kept a guy, you know, someone who's, she kept a, you know, kept someone's medical in place so that their wife's health care be covered when they were very sick, you know. I think she just was not a good cultural match for the people she was dealing with, and it was not a good basis for respect on either side. I don't think she respected gamers or the company. And they didn't respect Buck Rogers. You know, it's kind of like they had, I turned on the news this morning, and CNN had some guy who was covering Dragon Con.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he had a real hard time not being just as dismissive and nasty as he could be. He was choking it back, but, you know, and kind of sniggering. And it's like, okay, guy, you know, you obviously don't think well of what you're covering. You know, I understand. I've seen some of those fan costumes myself. But, you know, that's no need to be rude. And I'm sure you think your news coverage is a higher quality of entertainment. Actually, I don't think he realizes that his news coverage is perceived as most people's entertainment rather than news. So, you know, which is more entertaining? Which do more people get more enjoyment out of? You know?
Yeah.
And that's where she was. She saw Buck Rogers as a very high level of aesthetic and intellectual functioning. And games is not up to that. And most gamers didn't have that appreciation for it. And, of course, you know, she got rid of Gary Gygax, and then a number of decisions were made that did not go as well as perhaps they would have if Gary had made them. Gary just had a very good track record for the decisions he made, other than, of course, taking money from the Blooms in the early days in order to be able to sell faster. The thing that, let me tell you the problem TSR had.
Mm-hmm.
Their sales are more than doubling every year. Most of their suppliers that supplied them were on 30-day contracts. Most of the people they were selling to were on 60 days. So they had one California outlet that was huge for them, and that outlet was on 30 days. And the result was that they were in a huge cash crunch, a huge constant cash crunch. You know, if their sales had only gone up 10, 15% a year, they could have self-financed it easily, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
But when you're doubling every year, sure, you're making money hand over fist in a really impressive way, but, you know, your base costs are just exploding. And that was the problem they had. And the Random House deal, where Random House became the publisher, was great until they had a huge chunk of inventory that Random House sent back and they had to buy back. Because they had a contract where they swallowed the losses if that happened.
Hmm.
But, you know, that was... But Gary was looking at a way to finance his growth. And he was right on a management economic standpoint that being able to finance it and continuing his doubling or more every year versus having to, you know, just cut back or encouraging people to do things like photocopy the rule sets or, you know, produce, you know, competing products like Caltech Warlock, which was basically a copy of Dungeons and Dragons with spell points added on.
Right.
You know, both of those were not good alternatives. And so, you know, that's what ended up with him out of control, not having control of the company, and caused things to go downhill from there. But, you know, the growth curve was phenomenal. There was a real question, what was it going to top out? You know, and I think we now know what Wizards of the Coast current sales levels, where the top is, and it's fairly high. If he just had, if he'd been able to get printers that would put him on 60 days and all of his buyers would have been on 30, he'd have been fine because he would have had that credit overlap.
Yeah.
But, you know, bankers couldn't understand the whole trying to get credit for banks. It's like, well, where's the security? Well, there was no security. What's the product? And you show them the product and they're going, that's your product? You know, what's your business model? We're going to double our sales. Okay, you know. You know, we've done it for the last 4 years. Well, yeah, but you start out pretty small, and, you know. And the other thing that happened, interestingly happened in the industry, was, you know that Avalon Hill had picked up RuneQuest.
Right.
And they came out with a pretty generic implementation, but it wasn't bad, and they had a big game company behind it. Then they had an editor, the guy that was doing the next edition, Oliver Jovanovich. And bless his heart, he got arrested for rape.
Oh.
And given the fact that the appellate court reversed the conviction with really harsh language, it appears that it was completely faked. He was not guilty. He just had some crazy person who lived upstairs of him. Little things. I think like he was out of town when the rape happened. You know, there were a lot of factual problems. This person had a huge history of problems.
Hmm.
But the result was Avalon Hill got really nervous. They did not want to have a product that was associated with a guy who had those kinds of criminal charges.
Right.
And you got a feel for Oliver because some crazy neighbor gets psycho about him. You know, gets a psycho crush, he avoids her, and so she nails him.
And ruins his whole career.
Yeah. And that derailed RuneQuest. that would have other been a major point, because Avalon Hill put out their initial stuff and they were getting ready to do a huge rollout with the upgraded rules, and they were just going to go bam, 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 and really, you know, they were going to hit the market hard, and that would have been a major impact. And it didn't happen. They just kind of went, we got to hide our heads in the sand.
Yeah.
And I understand why.
Well, yeah.
But, you know, you feel bad for Oliver. You feel bad for the company. It obviously sidetracked the product. But anyway, thank you very much. If you've got other questions later, I'll be glad to answer them.
Oh, yeah, I know how to contact you. We can find you on Facebook, or we can find you on the forums.
Yeah. And,
yes, Steve?
That's basically what's going on.
All right. Thank you for joining me, and I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
You too. Bye.